Let's get started here for our legal holiday shiur of Memorial Day 2023, Tafshin Pei Gimel. Just going to mute everyone here. I love to hear your voice, but not while I'm speaking. So thank you to Milt Newman for sponsoring today's class. He says it's an honor of me. I don't know why, but thank you, Milt. Hopefully we can learn a lot about America, about Judaism, and about our own relationship with communities through this one. So this year, I guess as opposed to previous year, I actually didn't randomly search the depths of the internet to find a topic. Thank you to Henry and Rose Rostowski for getting me this book. Last time I gave a shiur, I mentioned this book, and I said, I don't have it, too expensive, and then Henry bought it for me, so thank you. And then while I was researching, this book came up all the time. It comes up all the time. This is a book by Jonathan Sarna. It won the 2004 National Jewish Book Award called American Judaism. If anyone wants it, you can get it for $2 used online. A bunch of different options for that. I was very grateful that it came in time because I was researching it before Shavuos. I didn't have enough time to fully prepare the shiur, obviously because of Shavuos. So I just bought this, assuming it would come out a couple weeks from now, I'd just be using this. Turns out it came early enough, and I was able to actually use it. So we'll get to this in a second. But in order to sort of frame the shiur today, so I don't think we usually speak about this early of Jewish history. Usually our discussions come in the 1850s, the 1860s. You can see this little handy-dandy chart here. The reason is pretty obvious. There are not that many Jews that are in the United States at this time, right? I mean, in 1790, you've got a couple thousand. In 1800, and it's sort of slowing in 1820, 1826. You know, we're dealing with 1825 today. Even then, we're talking about 5,000 Jews in the entire of the United States. So from what you recall, where are the centers of Jewish communities in the United States at this point?
Newport,
Rhode Island. Even that's even just getting off the ground. It's not even that.
Charleston,
South Carolina is the big city, and then New York City is the big city. So both of those, and then you've got maybe some small community in Philadelphia. You have possibly New Orleans, but even that, I don't know if it started up yet. So we really don't have a lot of people, and when we don't have a lot of people, we don't have a lot to talk about. But there is always something to talk about. Yeah.
Do you know why, maybe discussed it before, why so few Jews were coming at that time? Because there are certainly really problems in Europe with Jewry.
You're talking religiously.
Yeah, religiously or secularly.
Yeah, the Enlightenment is really just getting off the ground. I mean, there is not a lot of...
About, like, the pogroms and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that was going on in Europe and Russia.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, persecution has happened all over, but the thing with Europe is there are always other little countries you can go this way or that way. The only people that really had to deal with that were the Sephardic Jews, because the Sephardic Jews, when they were kicked out of Spain, they really had nowhere to go. I mean, Portugal was also just as bad to the Jews. They were kicking them out. Italy, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, maybe they could stay there for a couple of decades, but then they were persecuted there with the book burnings and everything like that. There wasn't a lot of place for Sephardic Jews to go, but the Ashkenazic Jews, you get kicked out of Poland, you go to Russia. You get kicked out of Russia, you go to Ukraine. You get kicked out of Ukraine, you go to Czechoslovakia. So there are different places you could go, which there wasn't as much of like a, in Sephardic Jews, there wasn't as much of like, it doesn't seem to me, like a unified effort to get rid of the Jews. Yes, and that's, yeah.
And part of it is they were next to the lumber. They were next to the trade.
Oh, the Sephardic Jews, you mean?
Yeah.
You're saying in Spain and Portugal, yeah. Yeah, that could be. So the first shul that really opens up is Congregation She'eris Israel. Anyone know that shul? You might not know it by that name. This is referred to as the Spanish Portuguese synagogue in the Upper West Side. Still exists today. It did not start in the Upper West Side. In 1654, there was no Upper West Side. In fact, there were no sides. There was just New Amsterdam. There was just this country, or this piece of land, I should say, that was open for the taking. And here you have the Spanish Portuguese synagogue is like super prideful of its shul. You know, this is, you know, Newport, Rhode Island has its, you know, its shul there, the Toro Synagogue, but And that's basically just a historical landmark. This is a shul, which is also a historical landmark. And they really, they hone in on it. They have all these anniversaries for different things that happen in the history of their shul. So this is on their website. You can find all these different historical sort of rundowns of where they went and at what point. So you see here, Congregation Sheyaret Israel, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in the city of New York, is the first Jewish congregation to be established in North America, which, by the way, is saying something. North America is not the same as the United States. North America includes Mexico, and at the time, the Jews, I'll look in a second, they came up from the Caribbean. So the fact that they didn't stop anywhere along the way and set up a shul is like actually a big chiddush, because the Jews were coming. They just never stopped anywhere until they got to New York City. Its founders were 23 Jews, mostly of Spanish and Portuguese origin, who had been living in, you know, say that, Recife? Recife. Sounds good, right? Recife, Brazil. When the Portuguese defeated the Dutch for control of Recife and brought with them the Inquisition, meaning the Spanish sort of powers that be also took control, the Jews of that area left. Some returned to Amsterdam, where they had originated. Others went to places in the Caribbean, such as St. Thomas, Jamaica, Suriname, and Curacao, where they founded sister Sephardic congregations. One group of the 23 Jews, after a series of unexpected events, landed in New Amsterdam in September of 1654. They were not welcomed by Governor Peter Stuyvesant. I think there's a place in Brooklyn called Stuyvesant, no?
Stuyvesant,
that's what it's called. Stuyvesant, named probably after him, who did not wish to permit Jews to settle in New Amsterdam. However, these pioneers fought for their rights and won permission from the Dutch West India Company to remain here in 1655. We think of that like, what? You didn't let them settle in America? It wasn't America yet, right? We think of freedom of religion. We think of all the rights that we enjoy today. In 1655, there were no such thing, right? So when we talk about, you know, them being persecuted and say, you can't stay here, I mean, it was basically Spain, or it was basically, you know, the English. Yeah, they were kicked out of other places. Yeah, a little more accommodating. But at that point, they still had sort of the territorial framework thinking about countries. So what's interesting about that is that the American Jewish community, as much as we like to look at ourselves as American Jews and look in the mirror and say, oh, this is what it means to be an American Jew, the American Jewish communities were Sephardic, right? They were dark-skinned. They said their chet like a ha. You know, we look at them and say, oh, those foreign Sephardic Jews, you know, from, you know, these Arabs coming in America, or, you know, Iranian Jews. No, they were here first. The Sephardic Jews were here first. They settled the United States before anybody else because they were persecuted ultimately in Spain. But, you know, throughout the next couple hundred years, they were continued. Mizrahi Jews, maybe. I don't know what counts as a Mizrahi Jew. But the point is that in 1654, the only American Jews were Sephardic Jews. And for the next 150 years, that's essentially what we had here in America. Small pockets of Sephardic Jews, traditional Sephardic Jews, who didn't really have any competition. It was just them, basically. You find here in 1790, you've got 1,200 Jews to 3,000 Jews in all of the United States. The most of those were just Sephardic Jews. When you get into the 19th century, however, so then it starts to slowly, you know, mix together with Ashkenazi, or I should say, you know, German or French Jews. So you see here, even from its earliest days, Sheyaret Israel had Sephardic and Ashkenazic members. Although the synagogue service follows the custom of Spanish-Portuguese Jews, the membership is diverse. This is today, he's talking. And it, at present, is composed of both Sephardim and Ashkenazim work together in harmony for the well-being of the congregation and community. Now, this is on the Sheyaret Israel website. This is how they are presenting the shul. It is not so clear that that's what happened in 1825. Now, it's hard to say, of course, but in 1825, it seems like things came to a head and the Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews did not get along. I don't know that for sure, but from all of the implications, it would seem that way. If you look at this last paragraph, you'll notice Sheyaret Israel was the only Jewish congregation in New York City from 1654 until 1825. That's what we're talking about. What happens in 1825 that breaks their monopoly? Right? So when we're talking about what we're about to talk about, we're not just saying, oh, some board members got in a fight and they made a new shul. So this was the first time perhaps in American history, I don't know, I didn't look at all the other cities, there was a break-off shul. Until now, and Sarna talked about this a little bit, until now, the modus operandi was, if you have a community, you have a shul. Much like you have in Israel today. You have a community, and that community has a shul. Nowadays, even in Israel, it's different. But the point is that you had New York City, and you had the New York City Jewish community. It was at the same place, everyone went to the same shul, and it was, you know, a few hundred people. Here you have a plate. This plate is apparently a picture of the shul that was built in 1818. In 1818, they built a new shul because the one beforehand was too small. And this one, I mean, this was a pretty good size. What do you want? What do you want to guess was the size of the sanctuary of this shul? How many people could you fit, you think? About 160 men and 130 women. That's a pretty sizable building for 1818. Welcome, Steve. 1818. So we're talking about a 300 seat sanctuary, not so much smaller than what we have today. We could definitely do with 300 seats, right? So, I mean, we have many, many other shuls. But that was the entirety of the Jewish community. Now, they had built that to accommodate the growing Jewish community of New York City. At the time, that you're talking about 300 firm Jews, you know, and even then, who knows how many people came to shul. So this is, we're not talking about a huge community. You see that there are actual, you know, a few thousand Jews. Yes, there was probably a few hundred Rosh Hashanah. I don't know if they all fit in this little building here, but the point is, if you want this, so the point is that this shul was the shul. It wasn't just the shul. This was the Jewish community, right? Imagine like way back when you had Jewish community centers. That wasn't like you could go to this Jewish community center, that Jewish, like Detroit had the Jewish community center. Now, obviously, as years went by, there were other Jewish community centers because other pockets of communities that went geographically other places. But you had one place. All the Jews were there, and that was it. 1825 breaks that mold. I'm trying to dramatize this to show you that this was the beginning of one city, two shuls, right? It didn't exist before this. 1825 is the first time it happens. You can see this during that span, the entire span of history, all the Jews of New York belonged to this congregation, which provided for all the needs of the Jewish community from birth to death. This was a one-stop shop. Share with Israel. It offered education in both religious and general subjects, provided kosher meat and Passover provisions, and performed a wide variety of charitable and other functions for the Jewish people. Keep in mind, by the way, that in our mind, that means, oh wow, you're doing a lot. But again, this congregation of 300 people in a country that has probably about 3,000 Jews, right? At least in name. Jews in name only, perhaps. Because there are not that many from Jews in America. This is where the from Jews went. Right, the people that wanted to stay true to the Jewish tradition. And there are, by the way, there are fascinating letters that we have from a woman named Rebecca Samuel. Maybe one day we'll talk about her. She doesn't really have an episode that we can focus on, but we have letters written back to her family in wherever, I don't remember where. She's living in, you know, Yehupitsville, Pennsylvania. She's trying to move to South Carolina so that she can go be with Jews that know how to do the ritual stuff. And her kids don't know anything, and she's trying to teach them herself and that kind of thing. So it's a fascinating history, but suffice to say, not that many Jews really care for kosher, but if you did, you'd go to Sheretz Israel.
So it wasn't just the shul, it was also the butcher shop and everything.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, to what extent the actual building held all those services, but certainly the people in the shul took care of it. So when we talk about 1818, where they built this new shul, right, so they have all these members. The truth is that these members were actually were brought in or maintained. The synagogue's success is due to a very specific person, and his name was Gershon Mendes Sextus. Gershon, I believe that was his name. Get the moment. So Gershon Mendes Sextus. He was, and this is from John Sarna's book, American Judaism. I'll just read here for you. So he was the person that really kept the shul together, right? Remember, as I said before, the immigrants are coming in 1800. The Ashkenazi Jews are coming, and you need someone who's able to really sort of keep everyone in the boat, okay? So just listen to this piece from Dr. Sarna. An additional source of tension has here with Israel, and throughout colonial Judaism stem from the ever-growing number of Ashkenazic Jews. Those Ashkenazic Jews, they always come cause problems. Immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe whose traditions, background, and worldview diverge markedly from those of the founding Sephardim. In Europe and West Indies, the Sephardim and Ashkenazim worked apart. They formed two Jewish communities, married among themselves, and coexisted uneasily. North American Jews, by contrast, worshipped together, as they had in Recife, with the Sephardim exercising religious and cultural hegemony. This practice continued even though Ashkenazim formed the majority of the Jewish population in New York as early as 1720. Okay, I got my numbers off. 1720, a lot of Ashkenazim there. The fact that the Sephardim had arrived first and enjoyed higher status partly explains this anomaly, but the threat on the part of Curacao's wealthy Sephardic congregation to stop assisting the New Yorkers unless they agreed not to allow the German Jews any more votes nor authority than they had hitherto probably explains more, meaning the Sephardic Jews got there first, they were the ones with the money, and therefore they decided what to do with the shul and everything. Nonetheless, Ashkenazim did come to exercise considerable authority within the Sheretz Yisrael synagogue, serving as officers slightly more often, according to one calculation, than the Sephardim. Jacob Franks, an Ashkenazic Jew, was a perennial leader of the congregation, and Gershom Mendes Seixas, Seixas, his most important and beloved colonial era chazan, was the product of a mixed Sephardic and Ashkenazic parentage. So this is the way he was able to be together. I'm one of you. I'm also one of you. You know, we can do this together. That would never happen today. I'm kidding. But as we're growing,
it might have happened what they'd be looked at as
maybe. Yeah.
Neither one would.
Yeah, I guess. As we're a growing number of other colonial Jews, Sephardic traditions still held, but Iberian blood ties carried less and less significance. Religion and Jewish peoplehood were becoming the dominant bonds among the Jews of diverse origins who worshipped together in New York, and power was slowly shifting to the Ashkenazim. Rav Gershom Mendes Seixas dies in 1816. So we're looking at really, powder keg, right? We're looking at what's just bubbling up. The Ashkenazic Jews are coming in, especially in the 1820s. The Sephardic Jews are trying to hold power, and this Rabbi Mendes Seixas is sort of able to keep everyone together, but ultimately the tensions are rising, and the question is what they're going to do with these Ashkenazic Jews.
And he the guy that was keeping them together.
The one that was keeping them together. He was the glue that kept them together. So tensions are rising but accelerating because he's no longer there. In his place, they do not hire a rabbi. Now, this is something that Zev Ellis in this book talks about a lot. He talks about how American Jews in specific didn't really want sort of the top-down authority, right? The American Jews were escaping, you know, this country, that empire, telling them what to do. Right, so they come to America, so in the 1820s already, we have the Constitution, we have freedom of religion, we have things that are already guaranteeing a person's own autonomy. So then when the Jews start settling in America, they by design don't hire rabbis. They'll hire a chazan or a shamish or, you know, a communal leader, presidents for sure, a parnas as they call them. But rabbis, they weren't so quickly to assume. Now it comes within a couple decades of this. But at the time, even Seixas was not a rabbi. They might have called him like Reverend Seixas, but he wasn't ordained, I don't think, if I remember correctly. But the point is, they were led and purposefully so. What?
Were there any rabbis to choose from?
Oh, so that was a separate problem. But they weren't looking for them either. They weren't looking for them either.
This was before the
Yes, way before the Frisco Kid. So what happens basically is that there's this tension, and you can sense it. But what really we don't know is how influential this one episode becomes. Because we're gonna talk about a specific episode, but I don't know if it's a simon or a siva. You know, sometimes in Talmudic terminology, you have the instance of something and then the reason for that thing. But we don't know if that reason caused that thing or if that reason is a expression of that thing. So for instance, we're about to talk about a a divergence in minhag, and we also know that that divergence is followed by a splitting of the shul. I can't tell you that this episode caused a split. If I were to make a movie based on this story, maybe I would splice these things together to make it look like that. But I can't tell you that's what happened for sure. Clearly the retention is going on between the Ashkenazic and the Sephardic members of the community already. And this might have just been an expression of that tension, is what I mean. So, okay, we're going to get to this. We're going to get to this soon. Let's get to the story itself. So this story, the reason we know this story is because there was actually a, there was actually a board meeting of She'erith Israel. This is wonderful that we have these. I tried to read it, I can barely read it. We have the actual handwritten notes of the board meetings from She'erith Israel in 1825. And in that board meeting, there was a resolution. Now, we can fill in all the gaps, as Zev Ellis does, and we'll read it in a second. But this is what the board meeting said. Resolution of the board on wearing talet by Harmon Hendricks. Who is Harmon Hendricks? So this I actually didn't know until I looked into him independently. But the Hendricks family apparently was in New York for a while. And this Harmon was born in New York, which is not so common, but is starting to happen. The Jews settling in New York and starting having Jews, Jewish children. So Uriah's only son, Harmon, I don't know what his actual name was, maybe Chaim, excuse me, was born in New York and graduated from Columbia College. In 1812, he established one of the first copper rolling mills in the United States in Soho, New Jersey, with his brother-in-law, Solomon Isaacs. The firm developed metal parts for warships, which were useful in the War of 1812, when the government issued war bonds in 1813. Hendricks subscribed $40,000. That's a lot of money. That is a lot of money. That's millions of dollars, probably. Hendricks was the leading New York Jewish philanthropist of his time, and he was the president of Congregation She'erith Israel from 1824 to 1827. You know what that means? He's not going down easy, because he's got the money, he's pulling the strings, and nobody's going to tell me what to do. Now, I can't tell you for sure. Presumably Ashkenazic, but I don't know. I don't know for sure. I do not know. But he's definitely defending the Sephardim, as we'll see soon. The following is published for the information of the congregation. At a meeting, if you ever wondered where all of our, pomp and circumstance and formality comes from in our board meetings, it's these. You know, the following was, yeah.
This was Spanish for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you missed it. Yeah, yeah, purposefully so. They like all that stuff. Yeah, we'll see. The following is published for the information of the congregation at a meeting of the trustees of Congregation She'erith Israel. You don't have this on your paper. I couldn't copy and paste it well enough. The committee appointed by a resolution of the board of trustees to report on the subject of persons not wearing the talit in the synagogue. Listen to that statement again. The committee appointed by a resolution of the board of trustees to report on the subject of persons not wearing a talit in shul. Meaning, they needed to get a committee together to look into the subject of whether you have to wear a talit in shul. I mean, they didn't know enough. They didn't have a rabbi. So they got a few Jews together. Hey, could you go look up this concept? Apparently, there's some people that don't want to wear a talit. Is that allowed? So if you look at Zev Ellis' presentation of this, more than anything else, the early 19th century synagogues in America were governed by inherited custom, or as Jews frequently and affectionately called it by the Hebrew word minhag. In fact, the Jewish law preserved in rabbinic treaties was fully outranked by popular custom, meaning what's written in the books doesn't matter. That's what we do is more important than what's written in books. We do in some ways, but if you find a custom that has no basis, then if someone to ask me, Rabbi, I don't know, should I make shlissel chala or not? I tell you, don't do it. I would. If someone tells me, Rabbi, should I do an upshirin on my kid or not? I said, don't do it. It's not your minhag. Right? I mean, that there is a force to minhag if you have that minhag. But if you don't have that minhag and it's not so well sourced, then you should not adopt that minhag. Depends what it is. But that's what's going on here. In fact, the Jewish law preserved in rabbinic treaties was fully outranked by popular custom. One instance in particular demonstrates a certain disregard for halachic literature. The curious case came before the trustees of She'erith Israel in 1825. An unmarried, so he's filling this in because of the board notes, which we'll read in a second. An unmarried worshiper refused to don a prayer shawl. Guy comes into shul, and he's not wearing a tallis. He's not married either. But in the Spanish Portuguese synagogue, we wear a tallis. Everybody wears a tallis, the men. Good, we'll get there. The visitor, calm and confident of his decision, explained that according to his Ashkenazic tradition, which he claimed was from his ancestors from Germany and France, again, 1825, these German Jews are coming in, a male was not required to wear a shawl until he was married. The leaders of the congregation found this cause for inquiry because the Portuguese practice was that even unmarried men wore prayer shawls. No one felt sure enough of the Sephardic position to rebut the guest. In great haste, the congregation dispatched the committee to research the matter. The more learned members could not find anything in the Jewish codes that would support their practice, meaning they looked in the books, there's nothing saying you have to wear a tallis if you're not married. There's nothing says that. More troubling still was that after a care, this is in quotes, in the board meeting, it says this, after a careful examination of our constitution and bylaws, they cannot find any law relating to this particular subject, meaning it's not in the Shulchan Aruch, it's not in the Torah, it's not in any of the other books that they have, and it's not in our own bylaws. So you know what they did? They made a bylaw. This is how strongly held they had this conviction, as you read in the board notes itself. But inasmuch as it has always been strictly observed in this congregation from its first establishment, the committee cannot but view a departure from it as an innovation. Meaning, if you're not going to wear tallis, you are breaking the minhag. Which, if permitted to pass unnoticed, if we would let them do this, may lead to other deviations and ultimately to the subversion of all venerable and established usages of this congregation. Slippery slope argument already in 1825. If we let him not wear a tallis, so then what's the next? He's going to eat pork. Right? Because they didn't know any better. They didn't know that there were other minhagim. They didn't have a mishnah. The mishnah wasn't alive yet. They didn't have, you know, the Magen Avraham on the Shulchan Aruch, which says it explicitly, which was published 100 years beforehand. Now, if they had a Shulchan Aruch and they knew how to read it, they would have seen it in there. It's right there in Hilchos Tzitzis. You know, in Simon Chas, as we'll see in a second. Yes.
Did they follow at all any precedents from Europe, from Spain, Portugal?
Presumably, but you also have to remember that these Jews were paraded around Europe and then South America and then ultimately into the Caribbean and to Curacao, and they make their way up to New Amsterdam and they settle down. So. And then it's 150 years later, right? There's a lot happens in between.
Right,
so Jews come in, Jews go out.
There's some form of communication, maybe.
A little bit. I don't know. This is certainly out of my naivety. I'm going to admit that. I'm yet to see any responsa from America to a Sephardic rabbi. When we give these classes, the only responsa we've ever talked about are Ashkenazic rabbis. The Nitziv, you know, or Bernardi Lowy, the student of the Chassam Sofer, Rav Avram Reis, these are all Ashkenazim. I'm not sure that Sephardim cared to speak to their rabbis about their ritual. I don't know. I just don't know.
I mean, obviously, you said the Rishonim, reading the book.
Yeah.
There was constant communication.
For sure, and I'm sure there was.
And community. But what's interesting here is because you started out with that there was this glue of, you know, camaraderie,
right?
But it was only if you did what the Sephardim.
As of yet, that's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like, for sure. Yeah, and now the Ashkenazic are taking issue with it, right? They're finally standing up for themselves. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm thinking, I looked it up. Yeah. The Reform movement started in 1819.
Good.
So that they could have been concerned about the slippery slope. This is 1825.
That's possible. This is a little early.
That could have been a Reform guy from Germany. I don't know. And he's saying,
well, he's probably.
I don't get that impression. But 1819 happened where? That was in Germany, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. Okay. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
That could be.
Interesting that the German Jew that his minhag was not to wear a tallis before marriage.
Yeah. Right. He's coming from Germany and he's not wearing a tallis. The only Ashkenazi Jews that still do that are the German Jews. There is an irony there. I hear you. For sure. We're going to come to justify that and defend them in a second, too. In order, therefore, says the board meeting, in order, therefore, and as far as lies in the power of the trustees to remedy such evils, that's what it says, to remedy such evils, the committee submit the expediency of a law to the following effect, that no person, either a member of the congregation or otherwise, who is in our holy place of worship, willfully neglecting to wear a tallis at the time and period it is the custom to do so, shall be entitled to any mitzvot whatsoever. If you're not wearing tallis, you're not even getting pticha. That's what it's saying. You don't even get galila for this.
Now, this is not so far from the current issue with wearing tefillin.
Oh, cholamoy. We'll talk about that.
Where you send those people out to the corner.
Okay, but they don't kick them out. You don't let...
I was kicked out.
You were kicked out of a shul in your shul?
Here? I was told to leave.
In what year?
10 years ago, maybe?
That doesn't make any sense.
I was actually davening in the Ezra Shnashim, and the rabbi came over to me and said that I have to leave the shul, that how dare I come in and subvert them and hug.
This shul?
Not this shul.
Oh, here in Detroit.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes more sense. Yeah. No, so filling on Chol HaMoed is always a contentious issue, but whether it's the mechitza or no mechitza, that's really what the question is. No one kicks people out of shul. I mean, that's startling to me that somebody would do that in the 21st century. But that is an interesting corollary for sure. On motion, so that by the way, that was the committee. That was the committee's report. We can't find anything, but I think we should crack down anyway. Right? So if you're going to do that anyway, so then why did you even look at the issue?
Well,
right?
Because now what they're doing, it kind of makes sense.
They're strong-arming them.
Well, they're not necessarily strong-arming them.
Yeah.
They're saying, we're going to put it into our practice, so there's no question going
forward. Right. My point is, why did you set up a committee to look into it if after they look into it, they're going to do it anyway?
No, because if the committee would come back and said clearly that you don't do it,
I don't know about that. You think they were going to find that? They were looking for their own
medical. Probably looking for something.
Yeah, they were looking for something to hang their hat on. Yeah, exactly. So here's this is the president's report, the Parnassus report. This is Hendricks, what we talked about before, Harmon Hendricks. This is what he said in response to their committee report. On motion, the report was accepted, and in conformity with the same, the following resolution was adopted. This is the official bylaws of the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. I can't tell you that they took it out, but you're saying everybody wears talis in there?
Yeah.
I'd have to talk to the
day
before.
I went in before I got here.
Oh, yeah?
They made
you wear one? Okay, so maybe it's still part of the bylaws. In 1825, they made this law, and it still applies. Resolved that the acting Parnas be directed not to call to the reader of the Sefer, anyone guess how they spell Sefer? S-E-A-P-H-E-R. Yeah, we've come a long way. Yeah. Or give any mitzvot in the synagogue to any person willfully neglecting to wear the same at the time and periods it is custom to do so, or to be allowed to make any offering until he shall have, I love this rule, 3 successive Sabbaths conform to the custom of wearing tallis in synagogue. You can't just, okay, fine, I'll wear a tallis, I'll get in the way, I'll wear a tallis. No. You got to be here 3 Shabbos in a row with a tallis on, then we'll give you an aliyah.
Did you say no offering?
No offering. I don't know what that means. Donations, maybe?
Donations.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, but I don't know. The money's green.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there any rationale as far as, having a chazaka or something like that?
Maybe. Maybe that's what it's based on. I would assume they have to do something to not do
that. If you do that, is there any precedence to say you now have to do it?
You're saying that the person themselves would have to do it, regardless of what the shul says. That could be. I hear that. So this is what Zev Ellis says in the aftermath of this. And Ellis is talking about it not from a historical, and not from a sort of political perspective, as much as that's sort of like a religious perspective. Like the Jews were so unlearned. That's where he's coming from here. In other words, the newer congregation would have preferred to justify its practice through the ancient Jewish codes that fortified the rituals and religious practices of their faith. In lieu of this, and any mention in bylaws and other official documents, Sheretz Yisrael settled on a reaffirmation of its grand custom. capital C. And that was still sufficient to rebuff anyone who claimed an alternative tradition. Then again, for these Jews, it may well have been that the synagogue was the phalanx of the mimetic traditions received from past generations. It was incomprehensible to these lay leaders that their congregation did not somehow protect this particular custom. They therefore revised the rules of the synagogue to include this ritual rule, just as they would have any other that represented their vaunted minhag. In addition, the episode, as pedantic as it may be, revealed another feature of the American Jewish lay leader. This person, in reality, had little need for traditional Jewish learning. Fascinating, you know, point to appreciate. They didn't care for learning. They wanted their traditions, and they were going to keep them, regardless of what the book said.
So regardless of their understanding of religion's background, where did this one come to wear Talism? Where did that come from?
Oh, so we'll get to it in a second. We'll come to the halacha soon. True, a source that substantiated religious practice would have been quite welcome to New York laymen, yet it was not necessary, as the congregation still steadied itself with the canonization of its custom. To the contrary, textual erudition, like the kind brought to share with Israel's attention by Ashkenazic visitor, could only pose a challenge and introduce a divergent practice. Meaning, they didn't really care for halacha. Meaning, it's not just that the Jews of the time weren't very firm. It's not just that they weren't very learned. It's that they didn't care for it either. Meaning, you and I, we say, like, how do you decide halacha? Well, we'll look at the books, and we'll study it, and then we'll decide. If you have a family minhag, good then say, do your family minhag. The great American, you know, if it doesn't hurt anybody, go for it. But for them, it wasn't like they looked to the books for what to do. They looked to the books just to sort of buttress their point, but they didn't need the book. They didn't care for the book. They weren't going to go hire a rabbi. Wow, we don't really know anything. Maybe we should hire a rabbi. No, they didn't care for a rabbi. They didn't care to know what the book said. Yeah, they had Google. What do they need? What do they need a rabbi for?
No, but they didn't want anything to
change.
You know, challenge their minhag also.
Right.
Rather than saying that what they were doing all
the
time
to know
is wrong.
How do we know what depth?
How do we know that they?
Because they would have found it.
They didn't find any halacha to say not to do it. But in other words, they had a minute, they wrote it down.
Yeah.
If they found some halacha saying that you don't need to, whatever.
Yeah.
But
if they could read a Shulchan Aruch, they would have seen it.
They would have seen
one of the most prominent commentaries, even by then, of the Shulchan Aruch is the Magen Avraham. And the first halacha of Tzitzis in Siman Ches, he talks about it right on that page. About not that you don't have to. That's where he says it. He says it right there. We'll see in a second. So this is the Mishnah Berurah in Siman Ches. On the sheet, you can see it. This is the fourth of the Mishnah Berurah. Now, the Mishnah Berurah did not exist, okay? So just to keep in mind, we're looking at this topic independently now, right? Whether this is a legitimate thing. Why should you wear a talis? You should wear it because it goes over your head and it creates a certain modesty, but also a humility. You should wear your hat and then also your talis on top of it. Right? This is the custom of wearing your talis for more of davening. How much of davening do you have to wear it for? Some will wear it all the way from the beginning. Some will wear it only when shachar starts. Fine. That when you put your talis on, you should wait a few seconds. He would cover the tzvon al rosh with the talis. But really, you shouldn't. You shouldn't fully cover it. When you first put the talis on, you should cover it. This is where people sort of do the wrap around, and you cover half your face and you do it. You take the four corners and you throw them over your left shoulder for at least a few seconds. The four corners of the tzitzis should be in all four directions, right? Not like a reform talis, which all of them hang in the front. They should be, first of all, wrapping you, but also each of them should be in each corner. Mashma b'gemara, it says in the Gemara, and this is quoting from the Magen Avraham, Mashma b'gemara shebachor lohem mechas erosh b'talas afilu hutam hachacham. Right, so this is quoting from the Magen Avraham. If you look at this letter Yud Beis, is a quote from the Magen Avraham. It's a footnote from the Magen Avraham. You shouldn't cover your head if you are a bachor, which means unmarried. This is an implication from a Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Lamed. The whole story there, we don't have to go through it now. But the Mishnah Berurah just quotes this clearly. And then in Yud, the Mishnah Berurah lived in Russia, by the way. In Siman Yud Zayin Yud, he says the following. L'chancho, a child should wear a talis. Calls that, by the way, that's referring to a talis also. That a kid should wear a talis. If you were to look at the Shulchan Aruch, you would read that and say, oh, there's our source. Right? It clearly does not make a differentiation. In fact, it says that even a child who is not yet bar mitzvah should wear a talis. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. So if they knew how to read a Shulchan Aruch, they could have seen it pretty easily. It's in the 17th chapter of the entire book. You didn't have to go very far.
That what? That they should wear a talis.
That anybody should wear a talis, yeah. Even if you're a kid, you should wear one.
It does not cover that.
I don't remember what it, if it says that or not.
I don't remember. From the thing before. One,
yeah.
One that, just as the bacha should not cover his head with the talis, it doesn't mean he shouldn't wear it.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
And two, it looks like that they put their tefillin on before the talis. Because it says that you should...
I hear you. I hear you.
Wrapping around the talis is more like a piece of clothing you're supposed to.
I hear you. Right, right. Unless they're putting it on and then wrapping it after the talis. That's an interesting point. I didn't think of that. But says Mr. Shabura in the second source here, you have to wear one. Those who don't are mitzatev. So he's not talking about under your garments because he's talking about mitzatev. Mitzatev means you put the big talus. Ad shenosin lahem nashim. Those two psukim are next to each other, and therefore you would think that only once you marry do you have to wear the talis, because those two psukim are next to each other. Who davar timuha says the mishavura, it doesn't make any sense. The ashlo yisa isha ye yoshi vibata mitzvah tzitzis. Until you get married, you should sit and not do the mitzvah tzitzis. So it's unclear whether Mishra really understood the minhag, that there's a talis katan and then there's a talis gadol, and they would only wear the talis katan before. But the point is that it's clear and obvious for those who are reading the sources that this was...
Like the
Chassidim. I don't know. Either way, the Mishnah Berurah is not like this minhag. The Mishnah Berurah in Russia was saying even young children should be wearing talisim. Or at least, you know, people who are bar mitzvah should be wearing talisim. So the Spanish Portuguese synagogue has a lot to rely on. Now, the Mishnah Berurah didn't exist. Fine. The Magen Avraham brings down this minhag, presumably against the Shulchan Aruch, which is why the Magen Avraham brings down the minhag to say that it's different. The point is that this halacha is actually justified, but the other one is also justified. And they failed in neither of those in this shul. And therefore, they just said, okay, the heck with it. We're going to keep our minhag, and we're going to codify our minhag. If you look at the actual, so the Pinsky Chuvos brings down this whole thing also, that the Mashmah Gemara Shabachol Yamachat Rosh Batal Tafilu Tamachacham Lukkevel Dvarim Eil Kaman Tzmihu Zayin Veshim Ma'ariel Shnogin Shkam Na'arim Gdolim Yisatim Tzitzit Tzitzit Nashim Vesamach Al-Pasuk Diyu Tzitzit 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 They're talking about the big katalis. The Eil Talis Katan Vada Tzriach Lamosh. Everyone has to wear the tzitzit. Right, the kid has to wear the talis katan, meaning the tzitzis underneath, because he's not going to wear the big talis, and surely you can't say Shema and say put on tzitzis if you're not wearing tzitzis. Right, it doesn't make any sense. That's false testimony.
Do the minutes say they couldn't find anything but they didn't?
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'll read it again. The board of trustees to report on the subject of persons not wearing the talis in the synagogue have had the same under their deliberate consideration, and after a careful examination of our constitution and bylaws, they cannot find any law relating to this particular subject, nor can they ascertain the wearing of talis is a law of imperative religious obligation. They couldn't find either one. It's not in our bylaws, and it's not in the any sources. It is. They just don't know how to read the sources. Yeah, right. I don't know what they were looking at. I don't know. I really don't know. I would love to see what was on their table when they were researching it.
The early version of Google.
The what?
Early version of
Google. Google, yeah. I don't know. Maybe they asked around, have you ever heard about this? Have you ever heard of it? Nope, I don't know about that. Ulam, this is Pitzke Chubas. Mina exesh, shalo yithas ubach from Metallus, and Pashib Ikar benews, Poland, Valita. In Poland and Lithuania, Umikta Shara Minos, Midinos Europa, and other European cities, this is when the minhag. This was the minhag to not wear talis. Al pi gedoli Yisrael, shemedinos haheim shesemchus smicha al mamash al tivri magen Avram. Haniskarim liftor bachur mitalis. Someone look up the years of the magen Avram. Rav Avram Kombina. I'm pretty sure he's in the early 1700s. And it's in the magen Avram already beforehand. This custom. Let me see quickly. The magen Avram died in 1682, even before I thought. He died in 1682. So the Magen Avraham was well known, well established, and well printed. Meaning, the Jews didn't get to America until 1650.
Where did he live?
Oh, he was in Ashkenazic town in Poland.
Gambin
was in Poland, yes. So that's what he brings down, is the minhag. U'mikdas and aposifu tamim l'shabach al pitaras ha-kabbalah. There are other reasons not to wear a talis, be Kabbalah. About the common Jews of Europa, v'chem as volkilos as svardim, mis'atzim habach from talis. The Pesach Yeshua says, the svardim have always worn it, even European cities. V'ach ha'yeladim shi'hi l'chinuch, uksteem as kol ha'rishonim v'aposim shalol chilku b'kach. And as you'll find in all of the Rishonim, in all of the commentaries, you know, the Rambam, the Rif, the Rush, you know, all the Rishonim, they make no distinction. So then he brings down specifically, if someone who doesn't put on a talis, and you go to a shul where they do put on the talis, or the opposite, right, the halacha by the tefillin, which is the most common time that comes up, the halacha of not mixing minhagim, that's based on the pasuk lo tisgodidim. This is not a problem in terms of that.
Except probably because they made it their bylaws, maybe.
Oh, okay. So now, if you look at the footnotes in the Pesach Yeshuvah, it quotes the Rav Ephraim. The Rav Ephraim was Rav Ephraim Greenblatt. Well, American posik, but, you know, he passed away in, I think, 2004, maybe, 2014, I think I saw. See? People know Rav Nathan Greenblatt. I believe he was his uncle. Rav Ephraim was a rabbi host of those years. Yeah, I think Rav Nathan was his uncle. Either way, he has a tshuva here where can't find it here. I think it was his uncle. Oh, I just found it. But he has a tshuva here. He wrote to a Sephardic rabbi about this. Yeah, Rav Nata, who just passed away a couple years ago, was the uncle of this Rav Ephraim Greenblatt in Memphis. So he said he was asked by Rav Yitzchak. I don't know who that is, but he asked this very question. This is not dated. I assume it's in his fifth chelak, so probably later in the 20th century. And he was asked this, and you know who he asked? He asked the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And remember who the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv was? Chaim David Halevi. I don't know why that name is important to us. The Bnei Akiva Shliach the last 2 years was his grandson. David Halevi. So this is Chaim David Halevi, who was named after his grandfather. So he wrote to Chaim David Halevi, a Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and asked him, "Neil, what do you do? What happens when somebody comes into your Sephardic shul and doesn't wear a talis?" So he says like this, "Hinei b'din zek farkasati ba'asei l'charav, chel tzlishi simin alef." I already wrote in my other book, "Ve'alish shaderech hatova v'hamuv cheres," the best thing to do, the best thing to do, They should wear a talis. That would be the best thing to do.
In a Sephardi place.
It'd be better if the parents taught their children to wear talis when they're davening Sephardi shuls. V'shamlo Irish mitzvahim Sephardim. V'kol shekein hu menidon didan. That's not even if they're davening with Sephardi, and surely when they are davening with Sephardi, lino gikach, mishum shem spalim yom atzibar hanog mitzatet, v'zenir'e kemo lo sisko judu. This is what Rav Chaim Devon Halevi is saying. It looks like in a violation of that precept, you can't have different minhagim in the same shul. Right? You don't want to make it look like there are two separate sets of Torah laws. Aval be'emes, says Rav Chaim David Halevi, ein b'zeh mishum lo sisko judu. V'im lo yirse l'shanas v'ne gadaso, v'rotsa l'hamdi davkaz in nisuin, Any roa b'zeh chashash lo tisko dudu. Even Rav Chaim Tavad Alevi says, there's no problem. If he really is adamant, he doesn't want to put a talis on, he doesn't have to. Kevan, why? And this is the kicker for us. This is the kicker for us. If we were in the board meeting at the Sheiris Israel in 1825, we would bring this to the fore. He says, Kevan shekvar zeh yadua umeforsam. Afilu b'karef ha-hamon, because it's clearly popularized and known in the general public that there are two different minhagim. There's some people that wear a talis, and some people that don't wear a talis. So if you're in a shul that doesn't wear a talis, and you're coming in with a talis on, or if you're in a shul that does wear a talis, and you're coming without a talis on, no one's going to look at you and say, hey, you are violating the Torah. You are going against our Torah. Why? Because they know that at the Ashkenazic shul next door, they don't wear talisim over there. So no one's going to accuse you of violating the Torah. It happens all the time. Even though not everybody knows why, it's still clear. They know that other people don't wear talisim. So that brings us to the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. They stumbled on the truth, in my opinion. They stumbled on the truth because, while it's true, there's certainly scholarship that points to their minhag, and there's other scholarship that points to this random German Jew's minhag. Nonetheless, for them, at that time, in 1825, when nobody knows a different minhag, they don't know such things. So then, yes, it is a deviation from the minhag. And they have to clamp down on that, according to of Chaim David Halevi. That would be true today. It just happens to be that today everybody knows Minah. Yeah.
So no one that talks about if there's any kind of chiyuv. So you could almost say...
Mishnah Berurah sounds like that, but yeah.
But you could almost say that the equivalent of wearing a hat. Places that have Minah to wear a black hat, not to wear a black hat, and how much can they enforce and so on. I mean,
given
any women enforce. You can't get a maid, you can't be a child.
Right.
But
assuming you're wearing tzitzis underneath. We don't know if they're actually wearing tzitzis underneath or not. There is an interesting historical note that I read about why the minhag developed to not wear a talis kadol, and that is financial, which is you have to wear that or make that, produce that. So in the 1600s, it wasn't easy to make talisim for everybody. Okay, wait till you get older, you get a parnasa, so you make your own money, and then you can afford your talis yourself. So these Jews coming into America, the Sephardic Jews could afford the talisim, right? Harmon Hendricks, who's buying $40,000 worth of bonds, he could afford a talis gadol, right? But this German Jew coming over as an immigrant, you know, escaping persecution in the 1820s, you know, he doesn't have a lot of money to do things. I'm not putting a talis on. That's against my minhag. You're going to force me to buy a talis? I don't have that kind of money. I'll rather keep my minhag. Long story short, I can't tell you, as I said before, whether this is the simon, this is just an expression of the tension, or that this episode actually was a breaking point. But later on in that year, in October of 1825, they create a new shul called B'nai Jeshurun, which still exists today, not the one you're probably thinking of in Teaneck, but the one in New York City. B'nai Jeshurun opens up. It is now basically non-denominational. They have no religious ritual there. They have services, but it's almost always some kind of study or some kind of cultural activism thing. I looked at the website. I looked at their services. They have services. I didn't go through it too much to understand what they're davening and why they're davening. But
is that how it started? So
that is the shul. No, that's not how it started. That's not how it started at all. Let me read to you from Sarna about when they started that shul. Yeah, that's a slippery slope. Yeah. So it says, rather than abandoning their plan for a new worship, there's another aspect to this, which is the shifting geographical concerns. If you look at, even on your source sheet here, and we didn't say it yet, but that one source we didn't say in between, right before the Mishnah Berurah, the synagogue was in use for only a relatively short 15-year period, right? That plate with the shul on it, on the front, so that was made in 1818. They moved the shul already in the 30s. So by the 1830s, most of the Jews of New York lived in what we now call Greenwich Village. Familiar with it? It's still downtown Manhattan, but you know, Greenwich Village. Too far to walk down to Lower Manhattan on a Shabbos. As a result, the congregation decided to move to new quarters on Crosby Street in 1834. That was already happening in the early 1820s. The Jews were moving up. So this is how Sarna says it. Meanwhile, this is the existing shul. The Spanish-Portuguese synagogue saw the geographic shift. Meanwhile, shifting residential patterns drove many members far from the synagogue. They wanted a congregation close to where they lived. Sundry attempts to discipline members who violated congregational customs only added fuel to this volatile mix. I assume this is referring to the Talis thing. And as passions rose, synagogue attendance plummeted. The Jews didn't show up for this 300-seat congregation shul. With the proposed early morning service threatening to disrupt synagogue unity still further, the trustees resolved unanimously that this petition cannot be granted. An accompanying testimonial warned that the process service would destroy the well-known and established rules and customs of our ancestors as has been practiced for upwards of 100 years past. Someone had already proposed, why don't we make an Ashkenazic minion within the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue? If you would ask that today, you'd be chastised. You can never do that. Rather than abandoning their plan for a new worship service, the young people coming from Germany, gathering with renewed ardor to promote their more strict keeping of their faith. I don't know what that means, but it sounds like they were more machmir. And urged on by Sextus's own son-in-law, Israel B. Kershit, who we've talked about in the past, formed an independent society entitled Chevra Chinuch Ne'arim, dedicated to education of Jewish young people. Their constitution and bylaws bespeak their spirit of revival, expressing an ardent desire to promote the study of our holy law and to extend the knowledge of its divine precepts, ceremonies, immersion among our brethren generally, and inquiring youth in particular. Meaning, we want people that know how to learn. You know, we ask you a kash on talis, and you can't even find it anywhere. Worship, according to this document, was to be run much less formally than at Sheretz Israel, with time set aside for explanations and instruction, without a permanent leader, still without a rav, and revealingly with no distinctions made among the members, meaning there wasn't like a hierarchy of who's more important. The overall aim, leaders explained in an 1825 letter to Sheretz Israel, was to increase the respect of worship of our fathers. Stick it to them. We want to keep the halacha. You guys are the ones deviating. Okay. Oh, so this is fascinating also. In these endeavors, we see all of themes familiar to us from general history of American religion in this era. Meaning, set aside the religious part. Besides that, we find revivalism, challenge to authority, a new form of organization, anti-elitism, and radical democratization. Meaning, we should make the decisions, not any authorities, whether it's a president or a rabbi. Given the spirit and age of the fortunate availability of funding, it comes as no surprise that the young people plunged ahead, boldly announcing their intention to erect a new synagogue in the city that would follow the German and Polish minhag, and be located in a more convenient situation for those residing uptown. On November 15th, the new congregation applied for incorporation as B'nai Jeshurun, New York's first Ashkenazic congregation. Now, they're not a congregation. I mean, you can look online. They have fancy building and fancy whatever, but they're not a congregation at all. As if conscious of the momentous step they were taking, B'nai Jeshurun's leaders took pains to justify their actions on both American and Jewish grounds. Firstly, observe that the wise and republican laws of this country are based upon universal toleration given to every citizen, sojourner, and sojourner the right to worship according to the dictate of his conscience. Meaning, the Constitution's backing us. We can do any religion we want. That's the First Amendment. Second, they recall that the mode of worship in the established synagogue, the term is very revealing, is not in accordance with the rights and customs of said German and Polish Jews. In the history of how this goes down, it basically, the Germans wanted their Ashkenazic nusach, so they made a new shul. It doesn't seem like that was the only thing going on. If you look at the board minutes of the shul, Sheretz Israel, it talks about how they want to borrow Sifrei Torah. They want us to, and history says that the rabbis of Sheretz, or the members of Sheretz Israel, went to the other shul and sort of celebrated the new shul, right? It sounds like they tried to smooth things over as if to say, you can be the Ashkenazic shul, we'll be the Sephardi shul, and all bygones will be bygones. But clearly there was some tension and some friction beforehand. So that's the sort of the first break-off, at least in New York City, if not all of America, and that's the story of the man who refused to put on the talis, whether for financial reasons. We can speculate from day to day to tomorrow. We don't have any evidence one way or the other. But what is clear is the lack of religiosity, the lack of scholarship, and the sort of the territorialism of the Sephardic Jews gave way to the creation of the first break-off of the Ashkenazic Jews, using America as their backing and also their Nusach as their backing. So that's the, I don't know if you can call it the first break-off in American Jewish history, but certainly a dramatic one, already in 1825, almost 200 years ago. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. All right, everyone have a good Memorial Day. Thank you to all of the soldiers for all of their efforts in procuring our safety and making sure we have the freedom of religion that we enjoy. And thank you to Milt Newman for sponsoring the class. Everyone have a good day.